Well, thank you, Michael, and good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be involved with the CEDA EPO again this year. It was one of Paul Keating's economic advisors tells us this very interesting story about how they were sitting around his office one day and there was a sound of a branch snapping. And what that sound was, the economy buckling under the 17% cash rate that the Reserve Bank had just put in place at that time. And of course, it was just before the recession we had to have as well. And I would say that the shift late last year from reasonably positive views about the outlook for 2019 to where we sit today, where there's a lot more pessimism than there was only a couple of months ago, has some similarities in the speed of the turnaround that we're seeing. So the question that economists have to answer, and I'll try and answer today, is, well, has that economic branch snapped again? Is the gloom that we're seeing right now justified? Well, of course, the recession we had to have was actually the last time we had a recession in Australia, and that was nearly 28 years ago now. But if I'd spent that last 28 years on Mars and flew in this morning and asked for a bit of an update on what's happening with the economy, well, any economist would have given me a chart like this one, showing you some of the key economic indicators, and I'd look at that chart and I would see that the growth is running at around about 2.75% a year. And that's what we now regard as normal or trend growth for Australia. I'd see that unemployment is down at 5%, which is the number that many economists think is equal to full employment for Australia. I'd see wages starting to lift slowly, although not enough to really shift the dial on inflation, which does remain below the Reserve Bank's 2-3% target range at the moment. Now, if I lifted my gaze from that chart and looked around, well, I'd see that commodity prices are generating a lot of extra income for the Australian economy again. I'd see that the ratings agencies have decided that Australia is actually a pretty safe AAA after all. I'm not going to get the downgrade that looked likely a year or so ago. We have some policy space that we could use if something really is going wrong in the economy at the moment. So, I mean, all of these things should be seen as good results and do sit in contrast to the gloom that is out there at the moment. But pessimism certainly has lifted since late last year, and it's pretty clear in the business and consumer surveys, for example, when we look at measures of confidence. So business confidence, the blue line on that chart, clearly a lot lower than it was. The green line, consumer confidence, very volatile at the moment. So it tells you about some of the concerns that have lifted there in the consumer and business space since the end of last year. Now, we can trace this pessimism, I think, back to two broad themes. There are certainly some downside risks to the global economic story, and the list there is pretty long, really. I mean, take your pick. Is it trade wars? Is it the mess that is Brexit? Is it the slowdown in the Chinese economy, geopolitics, you name it? There's a long list of factors we can point to that illustrate the concern about the global backdrop. And of course, domestically, we've also seen some concerns that are largely centred in the household space and to do with high levels of household debt, weak income growth, falling house prices and the like. Now, these risks are real. But the theme of my presentation today is that some of the gloom about these things is, in fact, overdone. And we think the economy overall will turn in some reasonable economic numbers this year. Now, it's certainly the case that policy makers have responded to this shifting risk perception about the outlook. And we've seen central banks everywhere, including our own central bank, the RBA, shift to a much more kind of neutral guidance about where interest rates are heading. In fact, what we've essentially seen around the world is the return of the two-handed central banker. Like two-handed economists, they're a real thing. And so what we're hearing from our own central bank governor is that after spending all of last year saying next move in interest rates is probably up, he's now saying, well, they still could go up, or they may go down, or no, maybe we'll just leave them where they are. Which is not really particularly helpful, but it does cover most possibilities in the outlook for the economy, I guess. And which direction they go in the end is all about those risks. How do those global risks play out? How do those domestic risks play out in terms of the bottom line for the Australian economy? And it's fair to say we start from the global perspective first. The the synchronised growth that I spoke about when I was here this time last year is no longer a feature. We're moving to a global backdrop that is much more uneven. Some countries are still improving, some are slowing down at the moment. And would I just pull out a list of some of those global economic indicators? What I can tell you is, well, you know, it's certainly the case that economic data has been on the weak side, and that that first chart there, the green line, it shows you an economic surprise index. And basically, when it's below zero, it means the data's weaker than economists expected to see. And that's true around the world. And because of that, we're seeing you know, much more ambivalent messages coming from policymakers. And so the uncertainty about global policy settings, the middle panel there, is essentially at a record high. So there are organisations that measure uncertainty, and that's what they're telling us. But what I think about the transition through to Australia, though, we're not really seeing it play out the way you would normally expect. So commodity prices are doing remarkably well at the moment. We haven't seen the usual kind of pullback there that would mean negative things for Australian incomes. And when I look at the business surveys, including the one the Commonwealth Bank runs, well, the final panel there shows you the export order component out of that survey. Anything above 50, as we're seeing at the moment, indicates expansion. So we haven't seen that global slowdown reflected in either the prices we get for our key exports or the demand for those exports as well. And if I turn back to the domestic side of the story, well, there's still a lot of positive news there as well. And in fact, one of the things I talked about last year when I was here was the idea that a fair part of the Australian growth story is guaranteed. And that's still the case. And I've pulled out a couple of charts here again illustrating the point. So we're still in the ramp-up phase with all this LNG production. A couple of months ago, Australia became the biggest exporter of LNG in the world, and that process has further to run. We're going to see rising LNG production drive a significant chunk of growth in the Australian economy. If you move to the middle panel, well, there's big infrastructure booms underway in many of the Australian states right now. These are multi-year projects that have started. They'll go through to completion. We're going to get the growth from that. And the final panel, just looking at part of the Asian story there, we're now in the interesting position where per capita income in Asia is actually now above the global average for the first time. If you multiply that by the 3.5 billion people in Asia, then you've got a very, very powerful spending force that's reshaping parts of the Australian story. And you can see it particularly in things like tourism and education, of course. So all of these things obviously are positives in terms of the general outlook. What I can also say relative to when I was here a year ago, that some of the risks I talked about then now look to be actually less risky. And again, a couple of charts here illustrating the point. So one of the things I talked about last year was the lack of wages growth in Australia and how that income constraint was a risk to consumer activity. Well, you can see on the chart on the left, there has been a bit of a pickup in wages growth. It's very modest, but we are now heading in the right direction. Also talked about the lack of business capex, but the chart on the right-hand side there shows you over the last year that businesses have started spending pretty aggressively in that space. So some of those risks have receded. The real risk issues, though, I think relate to something that's been in play for the last couple of years, and that is the regulators became concerned a couple of years ago about how much investor activity was going into the housing market and how much interest-only lending was underway at the time. And they saw both of these things as big risks to financial stability. And so they took steps to rein in those financial stability risks. It's been very successful. And in fact, they've taken those regulations away in the early part of this year. But I think partly what they've done there is turn what was a financial stability risk into a macroeconomic risk. And the chart here, I think, makes the point. So this chart shows you out of all that housing debt out there, there's been a very large pullback in the share of it that's interest-only lending, which is what the regulators wanted. There's been a big pullback in the amount of that lending that's been done to investors as well. So mission accomplished as far as the regulators are concerned. We've reduced risks. But the question is, how have the banks achieved this? Well, one of the things they've done, of course, is they've made it a lot more difficult to get an interest-only loan. And in fact, typically when you come to the end of your existing interest-only loan, they will make you switch to a principal and interest loan. And what's happening here, as these borrowers are discovering, is their repayments are going up by 30 to 40% when they do that. Now, there's no way their income growth is going to compensate for that. And to the extent that people are paying their mortgages first, it just means that you have less available to spend on the other parts of the story. So consumer spending is at risk in this environment, we think. And we can move on from there and again look at some of the data that the Commonwealth Bank generates out of its business. We run a survey every month of our customers, and there's about 2.5 million households in this survey, so it gives us a very good feel for what's happening with their incomes, with their spending, their wealth and the like. And I've just picked out some of the high-level results in this particular chart here. And the green line, essentially it's the consumer spending line from that survey, and you can see at the end of the chart there has been a bit of a pullback. So it does look like some of these issues in terms of how we finance our home loans and the like is starting to have a negative impact in the consumer space. What also shows, of course, if you look at the red line, is that household wealth is falling at the moment, and it's falling because house prices are falling, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, of course. But again, I think you can track this back, at least initially, to the regulations. So these regulations were designed to encourage investors out of the housing market. If you take a big chunk of demand out of the housing market, then it's not surprising, like in any market, less demand equals typically lower prices. There was a very interesting chart the Reserve Bank has constructed, which what they did is they divided house prices up into two segments. The pink line on this chart, which shows you what's happening in prices in the investor-driven segment, where investors dominate, and then the blue line is the rest of the market, so owner-occupiers essentially. But you can see where I've marked those various regulations coming in, how an increasing gap has opened up between those two lines. So it looks like initially at least falling prices were in response to these regulatory changes. The good news in that, in a sense, is prices are falling not because there's some big imbalance in the housing market that will drive these 30 to 40% falls that some commentators want to forecast. But of course, once prices start falling, it does generate its own momentum, and we've seen prices fall more broadly. But the initial driver appears to be regulation, and again, we've created a risk from that. And certainly, it looks to be the case that prices will fall further in 2019. We're not quite at the bottom yet. A lot of this story, again, is a Sydney and Melbourne story, and certainly a different trajectory in prices still, I believe, in Hobart. But you can see on this chart just how far prices have fallen in Sydney and Melbourne. We think ultimately we'll see a 15% peak-to-drop fall in Sydney, about 13% or so in Melbourne on the equivalent numbers there. If those figures are right, we're around about two-thirds of the way through the process. What we need to stop this, of course, is to see some demand come back into the housing market. There's some indicators there that are a little bit mixed. Most are still pointing lower, so prices do have further to fall. But we are seeing some early indications perhaps of a turnaround coming through, and I'll just highlight the chart on the right-hand side of this set where the red line shows you what's happening with the hit rate of on the home loan part of the CBA website. Now, probably tells you something about what economists like to do in their spare time, I suppose, but the reality is that hit rate has stabilised, and what we've found in previously is with a lag of about 3 months or so, when that hit rate turns around, then you start to see house price momentum shift in a similar direction. So there's some very early and very tentative, I stress, signs here that maybe the bottom is not too far away, even if we're not there just yet. Now, as I said, we think demand comes back into the market. That stops prices falling, but it does raise one of the other questions, really. Now, you can forecast whatever you like about demand, but if you can't get a home loan, then you're not going to be able to turn that demand into real estate demand, if you like. So there's been a lot of concern recently about, you know, is there some sort of credit crunch underway? Are the banks reluctant to lend and the like? And again, I've pulled out a few indications on this part of the story from the Commonwealth Bank's business. And of course, the Commonwealth Bank is the biggest lender for housing in Australia. And what I can show you is readings like you can see on this chart here. And I'll just pick one or two examples off it. But the first panel there, what it shows you is what's happening to the home loan approval rate. So essentially, what percentage of home loan applications each month are getting approved and turning into real loans. And I know that line's up a bit, down a bit, but it's basically a flat line. So the approval rate today is little changed. So what it tells you, if credit growth, if lending growth is weak, it's because of lack of demand, not because the banks have turned off the lending taps as such. perhaps the green bars on the end, just to make the similar sort of point, what they're showing is that average loan sizes are going up right now. Now, the question is, well, if banks were reluctant to lend, would they be giving any individual borrower a bigger loan than they were a year ago? And the answer is probably no, if they were reluctant to lend. So again, a lot of this is to do with demand, I think. Now, falling prices do mean a loss of wealth, as one of those earlier charts showed. So there is a risk here that we're going to see what economists like to call a negative wealth effect. So people try to offset that loss of wealth by lifting their savings. How do they achieve that? Well, typically by cutting their consumer spending. So another risk in the story that you can trace back to falling house prices and the regulations and the like. And we didn't think we were going to see much chance of a negative wealth effect, mainly because we couldn't see a positive wealth effect when prices were rising. So what is a bit concerning then is when you look at charts like this one, which show you various aspects of the consumer lending. And as you can see at the end of the chart there, some of that lending, new cars, overseas holidays and the like, has wound back very sharply in the last few months, and that would certainly be consistent with a negative wealth effect there coming through. What would help the story here? Certainly a pickup in wages growth would be very helpful, and explains why the governor of the Reserve Bank has stood up a number of times now and recommended everybody go back to work and ask for a pay rise. So please, on behalf of the economy, give it a go when we finish here this afternoon. What would also help, I think, is tax cuts. Now, we know some of those tax cuts are coming, but what we can see in government finances at the Commonwealth level certainly is their finances, their revenue flows are very strong at the moment. And so there's a chance there to top up the tax cuts that are coming through. And of course, that's one way of boosting household spending power. I'll stop at that point. I have focused on the risks today because that's really, in the end, what's going to determine where the economy goes. But hopefully I've also highlighted a few of the positives you should be thinking about that ultimately will deliver reasonable outcomes for growth this year. And back to my original question, the gloom in that case is overdone. Thank you.